Sandy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Had him on my whoa, Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jordan Schnitzer. He's talking about a fountain of creativity, Oregon's 20th century artists, and the legacy of Arlene Schnitzer, which is on now at the Oregon Historical Society through November the 1st. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Jordan.
Thank you for coming and visiting. This is an amazing show, and what's exciting about this is for anyone, because it involves as much of Oregon and Portland's history as it does about the particular art that my parents collected and my mother exhibited in her fountain gallery for 25 years.
So your parents were collectors. At age 30, your mother opened the fountain gallery because there wasn't really a contemporary art gallery here. And because she'd been at the museum school, the art school here, she knew teachers and artists and had a sort of built-in base. So what was the scene? What year was that? What was the current sort of trends in art?
The art community in Portland, no different than most. The majority of local artists have to work for a living to support their art career. And it's only the top artists that really sell enough to be able to live off their art sales. So she was lucky when she enrolled in 1958 in the Portland Art Museum Art School, now called Pacific Northwest College of Art, that operates in the Harold Arlene Schnitzer Design Center. She got to know these amazing teachers, Louis Bunce, Mike Rousseau, William Gibler, and they were just bigger than life characters that taught literally thousands of students over the years and helped imbue and infuse in them an appreciation for being an artist or being a collector.
As you come into the show, on the right, there's a great oil painting called Brazilian Screamer. It comes from 1931. Morris Graves, who died in 2001. And it looks like some kind of a chicken in the foliage. It looks, what's the basis of this piece?
Well, she never carried Morris Graves' work in her gallery, but John Brazelith Gallery in Seattle did. And in addition to the best of the Portland artists in the 60s, she also represented the best of the Seattle artists. And people like Mark Toby and Kenneth Callahan and Paul Horiucci and others. So she and my father saw this work of Morris Graves early, and even though she didn't handle his work in the gallery, they became enamored with it and they bought this together. And it was in the entryway of their home for 45 years. So it's a sentimental piece for me because it meant so much to them.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up, as a little kid, you saw this?
No, they got this in probably the 80s. So I was already out and about.
So you grew up in a house full of art. Did they talk to you about the art? Did they try and educate you, or did they just let you react however you wanted?
I don't remember specific conversations about art as much. We talk about art when we go to museums of other artists, and I'd go to the majority of the art openings at the gallery, and you know, they have lots of art in the house, and so I've been living with art since I was in grade school, and it means so much to me. I've often said waking up without art around me would be like waking up without the sun. The purpose of this exhibition, which was brilliantly done by the Oregon Historical Society staff, was to show artists from 1900 to 1961, when my mother opened the gallery. So the idea is that we would help people understand the burgeoning art scene at the beginning of the last century, and there'll be a second part of this show that opens in November with art that was from artists that she had in her gallery, many of whom are in this show that were making art before she opened the gallery. And it's a chance for people to understand the history of Portland culturally and politically, and what art teachers and leaders were doing to make sure that Oregonians had art in their cultural lives.
Mm-hmm. Looking around, I mean, the color palette for most of it is sort of grays, browns, greens. There's some, you know, kind of Western landscapes, you know, loggers, people sitting at basic tables with bread. It's very kind of early Oregon, before the state became a kind of luxurious place at all. It's much more kind of down to earth.
Well, I think artists in any community tend to do art that is, in essence, autobiographical. They're doing art that comes out of their heart and soul. Now, some have traveled around the world, and maybe they come back and do work about Europe, but they're living in the U.S. In the case of the artists in this exhibition, while virtually all of them were in New York, Paris, other places, and so forth, the natural order, the landscape, the trees, the flora, the fauna, the beaches, the rivers, are huge influences in their work. So that is a consistent theme that I think is different if you're working in New York and you're just sitting around all these high-rise concrete buildings all the time. So the early work that's in this exhibition tends to have a natural scape influence to it.
Mm-hmm. There's a small landscape here by Louis Bunce. Tell us a bit about Louis Bunce.
Well, he was born in the Midwest, and he came to Portland when he was 18, 19, 20, and enrolled in the art school. So he met William Givler, who was a peer of his, and then went to New York and worked at the Art Student League there. He went to Paris, spent years there, came back. So he had a multicultural, multi-art cultural, nourishing foundation. And he was a natural-born teacher. I remember him so well because he was such a bigger-than-life character. Well, he wasn't very tall, maybe like 5'8". He always wore these tweed jackets. Like many, he was smoking cigarettes, unfiltered Camels, and he'd be flipping in his mouth all the time. But he had this amazing voice, and he'd be moving around his arms, and he just captivated students like any fabulous teacher. Mm-hmm. Huge influence on literally hundreds and hundreds of artists, many of whom are the major artists in Portland today.
Was he teaching art history and how to paint?
Mike Rousseau tended to teach more of art history. Louis Bunce tended to focus more on painting and gestural movements. Mm-hmm. I remember my mother talking about how Mike Rousseau would bring alive the Rubens, and I mean historical artists, and give a perspective that she just felt was rapturing and scrumptious to hear from a master educator about historical art of the earlier times.
So you went back and purchased some of the pieces that your mother had sold so that you could sort of make a coherent historical review of the work she did?
I have purchased art that she had sold to others that has come up for sale. But I've continued to buy lots of these Northwest artists because with the thousands of pieces in our collection, we've had more exhibitions nationally of the current artists of women, artists of color, Asians, Hispanics, and others. In terms of the Northwest collection, by their estate plan of having all their art come to the Jordan Spencer Family Foundation and the work that I had, we have the largest collection of art of this time. And therefore, this exhibition and others that we planned help people understand the art world before the current vibrant art community that we have in Portland, Seattle, and Pacific Northwest.
William Givler, 1908 to 2000. There's a great painting. It's a family. It's two women and a man and a little boy at a table having breakfast. It's breakfast at the Wentz Cottage near Kearney. Mm-hmm. So who are the Wentzes?
The Wentz was another art teacher, so they were all friends. And William Givler, a peer of Louis Bunce, as I said, they traveled to New York together, to Paris together. But he came back and ended up becoming the dean of the art school. So he was head of the art school for a number of years. And therefore, he painted on the side, but his day job was running the Portland Art Museum Art School.
In the background, behind the people at the table, there are these picture windows partially covered by blue curtains, but you can see the cliffs and the Oregon Ocean and the dark green trees in the background. It's a kind of a combination portraiture and landscape.
Yes, I mean, the Wentz's cabinet was in Kearney on the Oregon coast, and so they must have gone there and visited a lot. And as I said, they all were friends with each other. That was their social scene, the artists.
There's a great Morris Graves drawing. It's called What's Gouache on Paper? The bird having fed on his own heart carries the night with him, 1940. And it's this black bird, very roughly drawn with a kind of gold background on folded white paper, and the bird's throat has a wound and it's dripping blood, sort of pencil drawing of blood into a goblet. Where did this Morris Graves piece come from?
It was in their house too. As I said, they became very enamored of Morris Graves' work and bought half dozen pieces, so this was in their living room. And it was there for years. They probably bought this again in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they showed it like this in the gold frame with the creases in the work?
Yes, that's the frame they had it in.
Mm-hmm. And then you said Louis Blanc was influenced by, Cubism and French painting of the mid-20th century. That you have this collection here of landscapes, images, afternoon. They're these quite brightly colored abstractions, sort of strange shapes in behind bars or in a landscape where everything's kind of twisted, varying degrees of abstraction. Do you get the feeling that people were leaving Oregon, exploring the avant-garde, and then coming back?
Well, I think with most artists around the country, they all would go to New York, Paris if they could, Europe, London, whatever, and then come back to, Kansas City and Seattle, Portland, San Jose, L.A., wherever. And they were always influenced not only by the artists in their own community, but what was happening nationally and internationally. So this was being done, these works. This is 1946, 1941. So if you think about, post-World War II, the abstract expressionists were the rage. The conventional art world thought they were horrible. Jackson Pollock throwing a bunch of paint on the floor, whatever, and but that's who these young men. Jackson Pollock was 10, 15 years older than Louis and Mike and these guys, but that's who they were looking and saying, "Wow, these guys are shaking up the art world."
Mm-hmm.
So they were evolving, the local artists, and experimenting with the influences they had from each other and from the bigger art world outside of the Northwest.
You must see that now then, and you're going around the world, looking at galleries, looking at young artists, who they're influenced by.
Oh, I think in every field. If you look at the medical field, the cancer research, if you look at, scientists, political scientists, but always we're influenced by those who came before us. And yet, to make our mark, we have to do something different. So these artists had to take the best of what they were trained and see what else was being done, and then evolve to their own creative genius.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jordan Schnitzer. He's talking about a fountain of creativity, Oregon's 20th century artists, and the legacy of Arlene Schnitzer, which is open now at the Oregon Historical Society through January 2nd. So your mother brought together a lot of artists. How important was her own taste? Did she take in whatever she thought would sell? Did she only take stuff she liked? How important was it for the artist to be a friend or at least sympathetic?
Well, I think over time, a number of these artists became very good friends. But in business, you always need to keep a bit of a distance between your business associates. But over time, they became extremely close to half a dozen of these. And she was a mentor, especially to a lot of the younger women artists. My mother, as a woman executive, burst through a lot of ceilings in town. There were clubs that wouldn't take women, have meetings, and she did her best in her own quiet way to say, I'm just not going to go to a meeting there because they don't take women. And she was a strong advocate for women being involved in business, and she mentored lots of younger women, both for OHSU, for Women's Health Center issues, for artists, and did a heck of a job in that area.
There's a piece here by Hilda Morris. So it's called Bantam Rooster, 1954. It's a very rough kind of Sumi ink on paper, outline of a rooster. Its head is back. It's almost like a cloud, but you can see the mouth, sort of rooster's crying out with its head tossed backwards. Hilda Morris was known as a sculptor too, right? There's a famous piece of hers right downtown. What was her relationship to the art world?
Well, I think she was wonderful. I remember her so well. And what's interesting is the majority of her work is all abstract. So the fact that this was more representational is fascinating. She loved the sumi paper, the paper where the ink would go on this Japanese paper and it would sort of all sort of move around and had a lyricalness to it. But she and Carl were an amazing couple, and you know, Carl Morris's work was right next to hers. And you know, his work, when I looked at it, always seemed to me like you were looking from outer space down on the earth, or sort of nuclear fusion and explosion of things and energy and all this. So if you look at it, you do see almost that influence of Jackson Pollock in this particular piece.
This yellow rock.
Paint splattered all over, and yet he has his own sort of style and form. And he would go back to New York more than most of the other Portland artists because he sold more. He had a gallery in New York, which most of these other artists didn't have. Hmm. And so he would go back for his exhibitions, and he and Hilda were able to live. Now, in the 30s, they came here to work with the WPA during the Depression, and they were based in Spokane for a while, I think, and a couple other cities in Washington, teaching art and making art. But then after World War II, they became successful enough they could live off their earnings from selling art.
It's a wild abstraction. It's sort of lime green and yellow and gray at the top with the blue and red highlights, and then these thick black lines, and then he's kind of flicked black paint on top of it, so there are splatters.
Probably the most important, in my opinion, works in this exhibition now, really by Mike Rousseau. And I look at these works, this one is called Untitled. It's like two, sort of like a wine bottle or something and another something, and
like
a master at the colors. I mean, the way he has these grays and hues, and they're absolutely magnificent abstract shapes that reflect, you know, objects. I think his work has just grown in my level of appreciation even greater than when I grew up having his work around us at the house and in museums.
So these are two white gray vessels on a darker gray background with a black kind of shadow. So everything's broken into these triangles and parallelograms. So he was doing kind of basic abstraction at this point. And yet, right next to this is a more figurative piece by Mike Rousseau. And it's two men. It's called To Move, To Breathe, To Speak. And there's one guy in a kind of zoot suit walking along with his head cast down. He's got a brown face. Another guy in a black suit walking towards him. They're kind of coming at each other at a funny angle, but the other guy has a gray face. He's looking away. And they're on this amazing pink and green background, which starts kind of at their knees. The green is the lower piece. Where did you first see this piece?
This was a favorite piece of my mother. She saw it and wanted to buy it, and he surprised her and gave it to her as a gift. She wanted to pay for it. He insisted that she not. And this was in her office for decades. And I think it's one of his most magnificent paintings. And certainly emotionally, it means a lot to me because it was such a favorite of hers. But if you look at the images of this painting, is this a statement about society today? People so busy, a little downtrodden, walking past each other, not being friendly. It has a very interesting energy to it. And it lets your mind sort of soar with different thoughts about how we relate to each other and society today and all being so busy and wrapped up with things. Do we appreciate each other enough? Do we appreciate just how lucky we are? So maybe he's in a masterful way with his brush strokes and the paint colors he's used, making us think about what these two individuals are doing and what we do in our life about people we see and know. Laverne Krauss, she taught the University of Oregon for 25 years till, unfortunately, cancer took her life. I remember when I was a student at the university, I was a English major, but I'd go sit in her class sometimes and watch her teach and watch the art students, some of which I knew and have stayed friends with. And she was one of those people that won't have much big art legacy. But in terms of her role, like any teacher, shaping and forming students and helping us become who we are, she, in my mind, was a legend. There isn't any of the probably thousands of students over the years that she taught that don't remember her as being such a huge influence. She was a tough taskmaster. She'd bitch and moan, but God, she was good. Mm-hmm. And they all respected her and really idolized her.
Untitled, 1964. It looks like a seascape. A lot of grays and blues. There's a horizon, and then the sky seems to mirror the ocean. I think it's the ocean.
She loved doing scenes of the ocean. And with her color palette of these blues and grays and the way the ocean and the sky would come together, she was a master at that vision.
There's a portrait of you, Jordan, in 1963, in your red sweater and your white collared shirt, holding a book that you're reading, finger in the pages. Haley. So this is by?
Sally Haley. She was the wife of Mike Rousseau. And as I mentioned, all these artists had to teach to put food on the table. So one thing that Sally did, aside from her art itself, was she was a great portrait artist. So our neighbors, the next door, the Ottsons, the three, Chrissy, Barbie, and Debbie, all had portraits done by Sally Haley, and so many of my friends' parents had portraits done of their kids. So she did this when I was 12, and I remember sitting two or three times for this, and I think she captured me pretty well. This was in our dining room, and when I was growing up, and then my parents' house until they passed away. And it's interesting. I have a little son, Sam, that I think looks an awful lot like me. And when he came to the opening, we both looked at this, and some people said, "Is that your little boy, Sam?" And so, but she was a wonderful portrait artist, and there's a legacy in so many people's homes today of kids that are now my age. They're lucky enough to have work that their parents had commissioned of them.
Mm-hmm. Was that just through a network of friends, or did she advertise?
No, she didn't have to advertise. She was in my mother's gallery, but once someone comes to someone's house that saw a portrait of their kids, boy, who did that? Sally Haley. Then they'd call. So word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And she did hundreds of portraits of young people in Portland.
Okay, a Hilda Morris sculpture in a vitrine.
This is what she's more known for. There's a Standard Insurance Company in downtown Portland had a big commission. There are other commissions around the city and the state. And she, I look at this, I stared the other day at this for half an hour. She used concrete and material on a steel frame, and the way she would create these images just are bigger than life, and I think over time have even grown in terms of the proportion and sort of a beauty and energy that they exhibit. As I mentioned, my mother, in talking to me about Hilda and Carl, felt that Hilda, like many artist wives of this time, a lot's been written about Elaine de Kooning, William Kooning's wife, and he's as big an artist as you get, paying to go for $100 million. That her work was really incredible. But during that time, in terms of relationships of men and women and marriages and whatever, sometimes in this case with Carl and Hilda, my mother felt that she, as a doting wife, let her husband be more in the limelight, when maybe my mother thought that Hilda's work was as good or even better than Carl Morris's, her mm-hmm. husband.
This one's called The Muted Harp. So it's a kind of harp with just a few strings left. And then this other shape in the background is very rough gray and blue painted, kind of lumpy plaster, I think, on steel,
yeah.
on a black base. You think maybe it's a metaphor? She felt muted?
Maybe. That's what's fun about art, is you can let your heart soar and think whatever you want. And whatever anyone thinks, that's right for them. No one can tell us that you're wrong in what you see about art. And that's actually the biggest topic of all, and the reason why art. Why is art important in our lives? In a day and age when, with the social media, the cell phones, everything, we're told where to go, what to eat, all these reviews of everything, art, and I would suggest nature, are the two last bastions where people can go, especially young people, and they can see things and ponder and wonder and smile, frown, but no one can tell them what they see isn't right for them. And if there's anything we need, especially with young people, is to be inspired and feel hope, because it's a complicated world today. It It's always been complicated, whether it's a little more complicated today versus 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. They can debate that in classrooms. But I think the importance of art for all of us, whether you're 2 or 102, of getting away from ourselves, away from our daily issues, and seeing these creative people that I think have a genetic predisposition to an aesthetic. I mean, we're all artists. We all took art in grade school, high school. We may fool around on some paper or something. But the artists here had, I think, a higher level of this aesthetic than most of us have. Then they chose this career, and they worked at it. Mike Rousseau would get up. He'd walk to his studio every morning, be there at 9, and work till 5. He'd take his lunch and a little pail. In other words, these people were very disciplined about their career. And we're so lucky in Portland to have had these amazing artists. And we're so lucky that we have an amazing Oregon Historical Society institution that is hosting this work and has hosted so many other exhibitions that help us understand our time and place.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Jordan Schnitzer. He was talking about A Fountain of Creativity, Oregon's 20th Century Artists and the Legacy of Arlene Schnitzer, his mother. This show runs through January the 2nd. A second half of the show opens on November the 1st, also here at the Oregon Historical Society. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus again, Jordan.
Thank you so much, and especially for Multnomah County residents, the museum is free. Free to everyone, so think about that. Doesn't cost you a thing.
All right.
And for you parents or grandparents out there, you got some time with your grandkids, nieces, nephews, neighbor kids, bring them by. There's also another exhibition of the Collins exhibition of miniatures of wagons and things that every kid would go crazy looking at. So come by the Oregon Historical Society and come visit these amazing exhibitions. Thank you, Joseph.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hand him on my whoa. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart.